I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and I am nearing the end of my time in radio. Today and tomorrow will be the final two shows. So guests and topics that are near and dear for the next 2 days. We're going to start with two of the biggest names in baseball who are both Milwaukee guys. Baseball is a fixture in my family. You've probably heard me talk about it over the course of the years. My husband recently retired as a national columnist for MLB.com, and our youngest son, Andrew, is now working for the Salt Lake City Bees, the Los Angeles Angels AAA team. So dinner conversations for men many years have revolved around baseball, but it's always more than baseball because the sport is in so many ways a reflection of American society, and to me it's also family. So we're delighted to start the hour with Mr. Baseball Bob Uecker, and then Baseball Commissioner Emeritus, just inducted to the Baseball Hall of Fame, Bud Selig, who returned baseball to Milwaukee in 1970. Later this hour, the wise and politically astute David Axelrod, who was senior advisor to and campaign strategist for President Barack Obama. He's now a CNN senior political analyst. And if there is time, a portion of an interview, we're going to do more of these tomorrow, of previous shows. This one, I was so struck by the conversation with Buddy Guy from 2012, who grew up dirt poor in Louisiana and became the ultimate blues man. What a story he has to tell. We'll hear part of that. But we start this hour with Mr. Baseball.
Goes the pitch, a swing and a fly ball, right field and deep. Get up and get out of here. Gone for Swain, and they've done it again. 12 in a row on a two-run blast by Swain to win it. Oh, my goodness. Cow, do you believe?
You put so much into it that you almost want to cry because it's so joyful. Bob Uecker is our guest now. Raised in Milwaukee, played not particularly well for the Braves, St. Louis, Philadelphia, back to Milwaukee. He was with the world champion Cardinals. We'll ask him about his contribution to that game in 1964. He's been the star of sitcom Mr. Belvedere, co-hosted all kinds of TV shows, made more than 100 appearances on the Johnny Carson Show, was in all kinds of commercials and in a major motion picture, but he always wanted to get back to baseball. He was inducted into the National Radio Hall of Fame in 2001. In 2003, he received, he was inducted into the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame for his contributions to baseball. He started announcing the Milwaukee Brewers games. This is phenomenal. In 1971, and what a run he's had. How talented and how funny for so many years. How funny. We'll talk about how you do that. Bob Uecker is with us. Hello, Bob.
Kathleen, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm my last 2 days in broadcasting, so I'm a little sad, but you'll make me happy.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to hear that. I didn't know you were leaving your show, but I'm glad to be on board with you today.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have you on. And you have been in radio longer than I have. I think we're probably the two longest-running Milwaukee people on radio, and you've done it longer. You know, I don't know how you do this, but you are enormously talented, and you are so funny. How can you be so funny even before 1971, but day after day after day? How do you do that?
Well, I don't know where or when it started, but I've always had kind of a knack for being able to create things in my own mind, whether they're right or not, or whether they sound feasible or plausible. I've been able to do that and enjoyed the success of doing stand-up comedy because of that. And that's where all of that stuff started before I started playing baseball. I mean, as a youngster in school, and even prior to all of the stuff that I did, you know, nationally, I made appearances at the smallest sporting events that you could ever find. Sometimes there's maybe one or two people, but It was easy for me to do, to create these things in my mind, whether they were true or not. They were, as I said, they could have happened. You know, one of those.
Right.
Where, you know what? I don't know if we believe that or not, but you know what? It could have happened. But in having fun and having a good time about, well, a not so stellar baseball career, but I did I played 13 years, and I played in the major leagues, and I think the first time that I ever went to do the Tonight Show, and when I did it, I heard Johnny Carson asked Ed McMahon after the show when we were saying goodnight. Johnny asked Ed if I really did that guy really play baseball. Ed, I think so. So they had me back in another week. I actually did three shows in a month, and from there on, I mean, I was kind of like a semi-regular guest, if you will, with Johnny, and we became good friends. But then all of the other things that happened, I mean, it was Bud Selig that brought me back here as one of his announcers, along with Merle Harmon and Tom Collins, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago. Tom did it 95, but when I came back here, Buddy brought me back here to work on the broadcast, which I had never done play-by-play before. I had worked a little bit down in Atlanta with Milo Hamilton and Ernie Johnson on the telecast, just doing a little color commentary. But when I got back here, I was put into the booth with Merle and Tom, and I actually started doing play-by-play, which I had never done before. I did it during games where I was sitting in the bullpen with other players, with the pitchers. I'd call the game as it was in progress and make things up then as to the game that I was watching or participating in. And then it went on from there. I mean, that ability to create things and again, as long as it made people laugh. I mean, if it made
and
people
it does.
Laugh, I went on, and I don't think I've ever had a bad time where somebody didn't laugh. I always thought, I never did it, but I always thought if I was really bombing at an event, I would take my clothes off, and maybe people would laugh at that.
Bud Selig told us the story. We talked to him yesterday, and he told us the story that you were a scout at some point before you became an announcer, and you weren't very good at it. I mean, you had a report that had a lot of gravy and stuff on it. Is that right?
Well, he sent me to, he didn't do it. Frank Lane, who was the general manager of the Brewers back then, it was the first year that I was here, and I wasn't working every broadcast. So
I see.
The games that I didn't work for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, whatever it was, they sent me up to the Northern League to scout players that they thought might be draftable players down the road for the Brewers. And back at that time, you had to make all your reports had to be in triplicate, and it was really kind of a pain. It's not like we have the ability today to take a computer and boom, 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 you're done. And back then, the reports that I had made out for that day, I went out to eat with another scout that I had met on my trip up to the Northern League. And we were eating dinner in an American Legion post, which was cheap. And Buddy wasn't paying a lot of money, so that was perfect for me. And, yeah, we had meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and gravy. I'll never forget it because Buddy doesn't let me forget it. But I dumped some of that stuff on my reports, and I didn't want to do them over again. So I just wiped it off, and I dried them, and I put them in the mail, and I sent them to sent him back to the ballpark, and Frank Lane kind of blew his cork. He took him into Bud's office. He asked Buddy, you know, what is this guy doing? You know, look at these reports. And so Buddy's never forgotten that. He uses that all the time. But one of the players that I got gravy on his report, we later on drafted him. His name was Bob Galasso. He's a pitcher. So my report was all right, and the gravy and potatoes and everything else were good, too. Frank ate the report.
We're going to welcome a couple phone calls for Bob Uecker, too. We have a short time with everybody, but our number is 800-486-8655, so we'll call early on this. You've done all these other things, but I heard you say, and I heard you say it when you were inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, that you always wanted to get back to baseball, and obviously you really want to be a part of baseball, and you've done it for so long. What is it about baseball that's so compelling and interesting and absorbing for you, Bob?
Well, it's a chance for me. I don't do all the games anymore. I don't do a lot of the road games, but each and every home game and some road games, it gives me a chance every day to talk to people. And you know, sometimes I think I'm talking to individuals. I'm not talking to an audience. I'm talking to an individual.
Right.
And trying to explain the game, trying to explain the situation. Today we have, you know, social media, so we don't get mail like we used to. I mean, I used to get tons of mail from people all over the country, and especially up in the upper part of the state of Wisconsin, people on farms that, you know, every day you become part of their lives.
Yes.
At 6:30 every night, the pregame show goes on, and you become a part of people's lives every single day during the summer. And that's huge. I mean, when you read what people send you mail-wise and now via the computer, it's totally unbelievable how many people grew up with you or with me in this case. This is my 62nd year in baseball, so all these people around here. And now, you know, with XM Radio, we're all over the world. The home broadcast goes all over the world. So you're known, you know, to people. It's not only the state where you work in and the Major League Baseball Network. It's XM Radio carries you all over the world. So
right.
Radio and your show is another one. I mean, you know that. I mean, your show is worldwide for that matter. And that's a long way from what it started out as, but I love baseball, and I didn't want to do anything else. I mean, I've had chances to leave here and go to other teams, which I never wanted to do. Bud wouldn't let me do it anyway, but even staying in California and working other shows, I didn't want to do that either. 6 years of Mr. Belvedere was enough because I was working summertime, winter, all winter, and then, you know, you don't have any time to yourself, really. You're doing shows and you're doing games all the time. But I enjoyed it. I really did. I never wanted to do anything else. I mean, there were times when these other opportunities came along to move on to someplace else, a bigger market, maybe whatever. I never needed that. I didn't want that.
I'm so glad you stayed, and you can hear it in your voice how much you love it. We're going to take a couple phone calls for you. Dave in La Crosse. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm going to miss you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Mr. Uecker.
Yes.
My wife and I went to Los Angeles, and we got tickets to The Tonight Show in 1983, and we were really happy and surprised that you were on the show also. It was Rodney Dangerfield, yes. Charles Nelson Reilly, and Bob Uecker. It was in, I think, March of 1983. And, Bob, you were funnier than people together. We thoroughly enjoyed the show.
I thank you very much. I know we were out there. We were doing a Miller Lite spot. That's why Rodney was there and I was there, and we were doing a Miller Lite spot in Los Angeles. And but, you know, the Tonight Shows were, I never had anything to worry about. I wasn't trying to promote anything. I was just honored to have a laugh with Johnny. And I started doing that in 1969 before they moved from New York. So each and every Tonight Show, I would do, you know, maybe four or five a year. I don't know, maybe more sometimes. But I went on there just to have some fun and have some laughs with Johnny. I never promoted anything until we started doing Mr. Belvedere, and then every once in a while I'd talk about a particular show that we were doing. But other than that, it was always baseball and some of the dumb things that I did through my career or that I made up throughout my career. I knew I could make Johnny laugh, and we always had a good time.
Mm-hmm. And you made us laugh. This is actually a clip from 1985 Johnny Carson show when you're talking about the Hall of Fame. I'm glad you finally decided to accept the offer to become a member of the Hall of Fame.
I don't want to start this interview off on a down note tonight, but as you know, the Baseball Hall of Fame just made their selections again.
Yeah.
And well, needless to say, you didn't make it.
No.
Were you upset?
No. I'm going to say this right now because we've talked about this before. Now there's a hint here and there that they want to put me in, you know? Well, now I'm not going. going.
I see.
I knew this would happen sooner or later, you know, where, you know, they keep putting you down, putting you down. Now they want me, and I'm not going.
And you're going to reject it?
No way. No way.
Well, you're a principled man.
Well, you're the first guy that told me that.
Well, it's nice to...
I guess they ask you so often, you just had to say yes, huh, Bob?
You know, that... I remember pretty much each and every time the things I told Johnny, some of the things that we talked about, and I always had a good time on The Tonight Show. I met a lot of... A lot of people through The Tonight Show that turned out to be friends of mine, and Dabney Coleman, for one, is a longtime friend, but Burt Reynolds. I mean, the people that I was on the show with are countless and you know, big-time stars, but we just became friends, and I'd see them from time to time when I was out in L.A. working. But that stuff, I to make people laugh, to me was... funny. And Johnny couldn't make me laugh. He told me one time, because when I do my work, when I'm working and doing that kind of stuff, I don't think there's anybody in the world can make me laugh. And I love to laugh. But he used to tell me that all the time, that he was going to make me laugh on one of these shows that I was doing. And I said, not on the show. Backstage, I like to laugh, but not out here.
Yeah, it's part of your genius, the face that you keep.
Well, I don't know, genius or not, but it makes people laugh all the more when you you look at them and say, what are you laughing at?
Exactly. Let's take one more call for you. Chuck in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chuck.
Oh, what an honor. Say, I just wondered, when you were behind the plate, did you ever get a batter to crack up with your humor?
We used to do that all the time. Absolutely. A lot of guys used to turn around and ask me what I was doing in the game. I said, I'm catching. You know, you're kidding. No, I'm catching. Henry Aaron asked me that one day. He said, I went up and introduced myself to Hank. It was like, I don't know, in June, maybe July. I finally got enough guts to go up and say, hi, I'm Bob Uecker. He said, what do you do? I said, I'm a catcher. He said, with who? I said, I'm on your team. That kind of stuff. You know, anything that... When you talk to people and you're talking really serious and you're telling a story and then they say what happened next, and I might say, I don't know, I'm making this up as I go along. So all of those things are, you know, for me, it's having fun. That's what it's all about. It's having fun. And I've had a lot of fun for a long time.
Mm, and so people with you. One final question. The Milwaukee Brewers are doing what a big thing. This is going to be a Euchre Magic 8-Ball giveaway this weekend. So my question is, what would the 8-Ball say if you asked, and it would be important that you ask because it's the Euchre 8-Ball, will the Brewers make the playoffs?
Call me later.
After you do the 8-Ball, right?
They've definitely got a shot. Sure, they're hanging in there. You know, nobody thought they would be where they are at this time of the year. So it's not a surprise. They got some good young talent on this team and some veteran players, and they got a good manager and a good front office, and they're doing well and good ownership. I mean, it's a fun time for me, and it's a fun time for fans here. You know, that Kathleen is what it's all about.
Absolutely. Well, Patty, we won't get to her because we're going to hear from Bud next, but she from Madison says thank you, and she speaks for so many, Bob, for the joy that you've given her family. It's a wonderful thing to have done in life.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Absolutely.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, Kathleen. Have a good one.
Thank
Enjoy
you.
Yourself.
Thank you. I will. Thanks. Bob Uecker joining us, Mr. Baseball. And we are delighted to have Major League Baseball Commissioner Emeritus Bud Selig with us now on our next to the last show. He was inducted to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Isn't that something? On July 30th this year, which happens to be on his birthday. So we're going to talk about some of the many things he's accomplished in baseball and beyond baseball. Commissioner Selig, thank you ever so much for being with us, and congratulations. What a big honor that is, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen. It was a great, great weekend, great honor. It was. I used the word overwhelming, and that's what it was. Overwhelming.
Sure.
Hard to believe, and Even if I look back on it now, 9, 10 days later, wow. That's all I can say is wow.
Yeah, you'll probably always say wow about that, won't you?
I will.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I will.
You've done some amazing things, all your charity work as well, and your work in baseball. But I've heard you say that the biggest thing that you ever did in your whole long, illustrious baseball career was bringing baseball back to Milwaukee in 1970.
Well, you know, Kathleen, that's right, and I'll tell you why. When I think back, and it took 5.5 long, really difficult years, people have forgotten. And, Kathleen, the odds were stacked against us. I mean, tremendously stacked against us. I guess I was too young to understand that, and we kept fighting, and as I said in my speech, we tried and we failed, we tried and we failed, and we tried and we failed. But we never quit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am proud of that. It just took a lot of hard work, but we corrected a wrong, and it was a great story, and I'm happy.
And one of the, to me, because I think this is such an important issue and what a lasting effect this will have, I know that the widow of Jackie Robinson is a good friend of yours, Rachel,
yes.
And that you retired number 42 while you were commissioner. Also, we have Jackie Robinson Day when everybody wears number 42. How important was that? That was important, I think.
Well, it was really important. He retired his number in perpetuity on April 15, 1997. And I would say to you, as a history buff, which I guess you know that I am,
mm-hmm.
that was the most important day in baseball history.
Hmm.
Most powerful and most important day. I to think we not only changed baseball, but we really changed America. And I'm really very proud of that. And so I thought that that retiring Jackie's number in perpetuity was really the right thing to do, and it was. And now on April 15th, everybody wears 42. Everybody wears 42. And it's a magnificent story, which proves, again, my theory about baseball being a social institution.
Absolutely. It sure is. And she has also congratulated you and thanked you so much for your strong support of the Jackie Robinson Foundation.
She has, and I appreciate it. She is a magnificent woman who certainly understood what her husband had done. And the more I've gotten to know her, the more I've enjoyed it. She's just a remarkable woman. And their daughter Sharon worked for me for 25 years.
Mm, very nice. Let's talk about leveling the economic playing field in baseball, which you have been able to do. And what is amazing, I was reminded of this by my husband, who's been in baseball, as you know, every team has played in the postseason in this century. So the question is, I guess it's not a question. You were successful in leveling the playing field and in restoring hope and faith, right?
Yes, restoring hope and faith, my two favorite words, was very crucial. And the fact that since 2001, every team has played October baseball.
Amazing.
Makes me very happy. And that's what we set out to do, frankly.
So of all the things you could have done in this life, you could have been a history professor, you could have been a senator, you could have maybe played baseball. I'm not sure how good you were.
No, that I couldn't. I knew early on I'd have to do something else.
You did. But you loved baseball. Did you go to a lot of games, minor league games, when you were a kid?
I did. That's where my mother started taking me to games because she was such a big fan.
Oh.
And the truth of the matter is I went to Borchardt Field in Milwaukee a lot.
Hmm. And so you wanted to, maybe you fantasized about being a player at some point?
Well, at one time when I was a kid, I was a Yankee fan, a Joe DiMaggio fan. I thought I'd be his replacement, but I couldn't hit a curveball, and they had a guy named Mickey Mantle who came along. So that was the end of that.
Yeah. I have to remind you of a story. You came to my wedding about 27 years ago. I didn't know you very well. And Senator Herb Cole, who was a dear friend of your, you went to elementary school and you've known each other. You were same fraternity for years.
We went to school, elementary, junior high, senior high, and college.
Yeah. So he was there too, both of you friends of my husband. And my father-in-law said to my husband, Mike, who was a columnist for MLB.com until recently,
right.
He said, Mike, how many senators are there? And Mike said, well, 100, Dad. And then he said, how many owners are there at baseball teams? And I think it was 28 then. So Mike said 28, and Joe, his dad, said, so who's more important?
That'd be good.
That's a funny story. So you could have been a senator, and somebody actually thought that you should have been Senate Majority Leader.
Well, that's right. You know, I'm complimented because the commissioner job is a political job, and I love politics. And so both Jerry Reinsdorf and Senator George Mitchell, who watched me, both said you should have been the Senate Majority Leader, and I regard that as a great compliment.
Yeah. So you love politics. Why?
I just have. I've always loved. I'm a history buff. I love American history, but I do love politics. And I can't give you any more of an explanation than that. Ever since I was a kid, I just loved politics.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It's been fascinating. Now that you are Commissioner Emeritus, you could, and I would imagine that you are, root pretty openly for the Brewers again. Can you do that?
I can do it easier. Everybody said the day I retired, why don't you go back to rooting for your beloved Brewers again? And the fact of the matter is, I can and I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've also been, I think it was Bob Costas, who I think is a marvelous sportscaster,
right,
has said about you that he thinks that your tenure as commissioner will go down in history. He didn't always agree with you, but he thought that the work that you did will always be remembered, which is quite a high compliment.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. You know, Kathleen, it was the most active period in baseball history, from revenue sharing to the wild card to many, many other things, which I'm very proud of. And the grand old game today as a result is really, really in great shape, unbelievable shape.
And why don't you, in the minutes that remain here, just sort of wax poetic, if you will, about the place of baseball in American society and what it does at its best for us?
Well, there's so many examples. It plays this wonderful, as I call it, sociological role in the sport. And what it does, and you can see it, there's so many instances, but just go back to 1982 here, and you watch a community come together, and really day after day after day, and it does so many good things. And so I'm proud of the role baseball has played. As I said, we started with Jackie Robinson. You go on to Henry Aaron and a whole series of other things. And my friend Bart Giamatti used to say that baseball is a metaphor for life, and it is a metaphor for life. But above all, it plays this wonderfully constructive role in our sport, in our society. And it binds communities together. It plays roles. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, I used to take players. I can't tell you who, but they're both in the Hall of Fame, so now you know. And they'd go to Children's Hospital with great regularity under one condition: nobody could ever know. And so, Kathleen, I have the fresh memory of walking into hospital rooms and breaking your heart with little kids. And my goodness gracious, they'd look at the faces of the players, and you knew then what a great thing it was for and how baseball played a role in society. And I often tell this story that as a kid, I was at a game in September 23rd, 1957. Hank Aaron hit a home run, to make a long story short, in the 11th inning, and the Milwaukee Braves won the pennant. And it was a great story. But the next day in the New York Times, and I have the paper now, juxtaposed against Henry Aaron being carried off the field by mainly white teammates, was Orville Faubus spraying African Americans merely trying to go to school in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, goodness.
And yeah. I have never forgotten that. And the Times heard me talk about it, and that's why I have now sort of a gold copy of that paper. And that proved to me what a great sociological force baseball could play in our society.
Absolutely. And how hard it was for both of those gentlemen to break through. What they had to go through just breaks your heart.
Absolutely right. No question about it.
So, Euchre's a real treat. Spend just a moment talking about your hiring him as a scout at some point. Was he a scout?
Well, that's right. In 1970, Bob came up, and Bob and I had known each other pretty well, but we didn't have any role on the broadcast team. But I knew he was going to be good. He was so good, and he did make himself. Don't tell him I said that, but he made himself into a great announcer. But anyway, I hired him as a scout, and Frank Lane, who was a controversial general manager, but he was great. He came in. He came roaring into my office 2 weeks later, and he says, "You're Guy Euchre." Yeah, I said, "Yeah, he's up in the Northern League scouting for you, Frank." He said, "I know it. Here's his first scouting report. It had mashed potatoes and gravy all over it."
That's a great story.
Yeah. So, anyway, fortunately, he became a great announcer. His scouting career came to an abrupt end.
Well, he found the right profession. He's done just fine. So what's it like to be? You're not really retired. You're still doing all kinds of things. But
well, I am, and busy as can be, and I like to stay busy. And between my teaching and writing a book and everything else, I have really been...
You're teaching at Madison, aren't you?
Teaching at Madison, Marquette University, and now Arizona State University.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so... and I'm enjoying it immensely. I teach in Madison every Tuesday at 1:20.
Oh, wonderful. So we can call you Professor Seelig now,
well,
too.
Well, they do in all three places. They do. Yeah.
I like that.
And it's interesting, Kathleen, because when I was a kid in Madison, that's what I wanted to be, a history professor. So it took me till age 80, 81 to become a professor, but I made it.
Yeah, you did. Well, congratulations. Thank you so much, Commissioner, for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen, and lots of good luck. And your extraordinary career comes to end on Thursday, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Bud Seelig, Commissioner Emeritus of Major League Baseball. And now David Axelrod is with us. Delighted to have him here. Chief strategist for Barack Obama's presidential campaigns, Yes We Can, was David's creation. He served as senior advisor to the president, senior political commentator on CNN, now director of the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics, hosted the Axe Files, a great podcast, long and highly compelling interviews with people like Gary Hart, Elizabeth Warren, Tom Cotton, John McCain, and so many others. And you see also as specialized television versions of the Axe Files. He did a beautiful interview with John Lewis a few weeks ago, which is a must-see, actually. He's the author of Believer, My 40 Years in Politics, a former Chicago Tribune reporter. I've wanted to interview him, actually, for many years. And you see what does the trick, as you say, I'm retiring. I've only got two more shows, so this is it. You got to be on now. And David, bless his heart, said, okay, he made time for us today, and I am grateful. We will have time to take a few phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. I'll remember that number all my life, I'm sure. 800-486-8655. David Axelrod, a real pleasure to speak with you, sir. Hi.
It's an honor to be with you, Kathleen. I'm glad I slipped in under the
no,
wire.
No, I am too.
Congratulations on your great run.
Thank you. It's been 44 years in radio. Isn't that amazing?
Amazing, yeah. Well, you do it very well, and you were nice enough to compliment my interviews. Yours are terrific, so I'm just very happy to be
Thank
here.
Thank you, David. Well, you know, I've always admired, you know, I admire what you do and what you've done, but also who you are. Who you are as a human being really comes shining through in the work that you did as special advisor and in all the interviews. That interview you did with John Lewis, I don't cry very often. I might tomorrow on my last show, but that show was so poignant, and it showed the breadth of your knowledge and the importance that you placed on the person you were interviewing. It was just so good.
Well, you know, I really consider myself a storyteller. I think that's I started as a journalist, as a political strategist. You know, I always saw my principal job in developing the message for candidates and campaigns as being to tell their story, to tell the stories of the people they had met along the way, to tell the story of where the country was or where a particular community was. And now, you know, I'm sort of got my foot half back into journalism here, and I'm just really interested in talking to people with great stories. And John Lewis, of course, is an American hero.
Yes.
And, I mean, I just sat there, and I was so moved by this guy who, as a very, very young man, just walked into the fires again and again, knowing that he might be killed because he felt so strongly about the cause of civil rights. And just an inspiring human being. What a treat to be able to spend an hour with a guy like that.
And I love the fact that you're doing that with so many important people, voices really worth listening to. You did an extraordinary interview with your former boss as well, President Obama, shortly before he left Washington, D.C. And you've said that the President Obama never became cynical. I'm wondering, and I know that he restored your idealism. Can you talk about how that happened? And I wonder if you're cynical now.
Well, I'll deal with that question in a second. I met him years ago when he was a returning law student, and a woman named Betty Lou Saltzman, who's kind of a doyen of liberal politics in Chicago, called me and said, "I just met this remarkable young man I think you ought to meet." And I said, "Well, happy to meet anybody you want me to meet, Betty Lou, but why?" And she said, "Because I think he could be the first black president of the United States."
Whoa.
I always say I take Betty Lou to the track with me now whenever I go. But I met Obama, and the thing that struck me was here was a guy who had just been president of the Harvard Law Review and could have written his ticket at any law firm or corporation in America. And instead he came back to Chicago to run a voter registration drive and to practice law in a small civil rights firm. And he explained to me that he had an interest in public life because he wanted to do something larger than himself. And I was really moved by that. You know, the world of politics basically divides into two groups. There's the one group that runs for their own aggrandizement because they want to be something. And then there's this smaller and more admirable cohort of people who run for public office because they want to do something, because they want to make a difference. He was squarely in that category. And years later, we became friends. Years later, he had lost a race for Congress, and he was really sort of on his last legs politically, many people thought, because he had challenged a sitting congressman. He'd lost by 30 points. He was broke, and he called me and said, "I want to run for the U.S. Senate," and which seemed pretty audacious, but he said, "I have one race left in me, and, you know, Michelle, I promise Michelle it's up or out. I'll go make a living if this doesn't work." And he hit me at a time when I was particularly downbeat about the nature of politics. An old client of mine, Rod Blagojevich, who you sure have heard of, I had worked for him in some of his earlier races, and he had approached me about running for governor and asked me about that, and I said, "Well, why do you want to be governor?" And he said, "Well, you can help me figure that out." And I said, "Rod, if I have to help you figure it out, you really shouldn't run." But it was clear he got a very good firm to work for him. It was clear he was going to win now, and he was running as a reformer, which is pretty ironic, as you can imagine. It seemed that way to me then, but certainly now. And I thought, but they did all the state-of-the-art things that I knew, how, you know, all the black arts of politics and so on. And I thought, well, maybe if this level of cynicism is needed, maybe I should get out. So Obama and I both were going through these existential moments about our political careers. And I said to my wife, Susan, you know, if I could help Barack get elected to the U.S. Senate, I would feel like I had done something really valuable. And that would really recharge my batteries. And that began this long association that ran through that Senate race, two presidential races, stint in the White House, and really such a rewarding journey.
And you really grew to love the man, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I have a just maximum high regard for him. He's a good human being, good family guy, you know, sensitive, and very, very much committed to the notion of public service as a means of bettering the community, of helping people, of building a better future. I mean, he is, you know, he represents the theory of politics that I believe in, that we have the ability through politics to grab the wheel of history and steer it ever so slightly in the right direction. And, you know, I... So I just feel really blessed to have had this association with him.
And what about the direction of the country now? I watch you frequently on CNN, and I listen mm-hmm. carefully to what you have to say. Are you deeply concerned?
Well, yes, I'm concerned. You asked me, I should answer your other question
right.
first, which is, am I cynical? No, I'm not cynical. Because I still, you know, what has been really interesting to me in this last 9 months, and particularly the last 6 or 7 months, isn't, you know, some of the really disturbing things I've seen from this president or this administration. It's the way in which people have responded. In some odd way, Donald Trump has reinvigorated our democracy. You see citizens organizing to make their voices heard. I think that's one of the reasons the Affordable Care Act is still with us, because people raised their voices and made their voices heard. You've seen the courts play their role. You've seen the Congress play its role. You've seen the media, really a reinvigorated news media, understanding its role to shine a bright light in dark corners. It may frustrate the president, but that's in the great tradition of democracy in American journalism. So, I'm not pessimistic. I'm not cynical. But I am concerned, and, you know, every day there are reasons for concern. The president's apparently offhanded use of kind of incendiary language relative to North Korea yesterday was just one more reason to be concerned. So, I worry about that, and I worry about our standing in the world. I worry about needless conflict. I worry about climate change and other policies where we're moving backward. And mostly I worry about the fact that we live in revolutionary times, times that in which I believe mostly technology is churning at such a fast rate that it's very hard for us to get our arms around all the impacts
right.
of it on the economy, on communications. And it takes wisdom and it takes a national strategy to deal with the impacts of that, people being displaced because robots and computers are now doing their jobs, a communications environment in which we can silo ourselves, and rather than being informed, we are affirmed in our points of view, and we don't hear other points of view. It's a very challenging environment, and I worry that we're losing time now in trying to get ahead of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend just a moment more on North Korea. I must say, and this might be me watching cable news, too, and it's hour after hour, and I watch too much of it sometimes, except, of course, when you're on. But I must say, the last thing I thought of before I went to sleep last night was North Korea, and I got a little bit concerned, partially because of the rhetoric and partially because of the nature of this North Korean state and the nature of these incendiary comments, as you call them. Barack Obama was in Seoul, South Korea, in July, and he talked about how we couldn't solve this problem right away. He would like to see North Korea return to the negotiating table. Do you think, David, that can happen?
Well, that's certainly what Secretary Tillerson is playing
right.
for. It's interesting to hear his rhetoric alongside the president's rhetoric, because his rhetoric is distinctly different. The reason the North Koreans want these weapons is that they think it is security against being toppled by hostile forces. And, the more that we feed that narrative, I think the more likely it is for something for some tragic event to happen. On the other hand, Tillerson keeps telling them, we're not interested in regime change. We are not interested in toppling your leadership. We want to sit down. Or he implies that there is a way to sit down and talk if they are willing to abandon their course. So, one hopes that rationality will take hold, and the way it likely would is if China were to exert itself more and use their significant influence with the North Koreans to bring them to the table. So, You know, that appeared to be the president's strategy at first, was to try and pressure the Chinese. Perhaps he thinks that by threatening, a nuclear holocaust, that that China's attention will be piqued. A lot of diplomats are dubious about that approach. But in fairness, you know, this has been something that's vexed presidents for decades. And
yes,
there's no easy answer to it.
No. Let's take a call from Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Steve.
First of all, I want to say I hate to see you go. You're a compassionate human being, a great humanitarian, and you've been just a tireless advocate for racial justice, and I appreciate everything you do.
Thank you, Steve.
And for your guest, Mr. Axelrod, first I want to ask, do you have any political aspirations of your own? And then secondly, for those who oppose the Trump agenda, would you be an advocate of resistance, a la the Tea Party, or trying to present a positive vision and pushing for that?
Well, first of all, as to your question about my own plans or aspirations, you know, there's an enormous amount of sacrifice involved with public service, and the sacrifice isn't just your own sacrifice, it's the sacrifice of your family. I've asked an awful lot of my family over the last 40 years in journalism and politics. I've asked them to make more sacrifices, frankly, than I like to think about in retrospect, and I couldn't subject them, as much as I might want to at times, I couldn't subject them to that. And I think, you know, right now, doing what I'm doing at CNN and at the University of Chicago, trying to inspire young people to get into the public arena, is the best use of my time. But in terms of what people should be doing, I think a good example of what people should be doing is what we saw around the Affordable Care Act, which is to make their voices heard. At the end of the day, democracy works when people are engaged and people are making themselves heard. And I'm encouraged by what I've seen in that regard. So go to those town hall meetings, send those letters, make those calls, support campaigns, not just for candidates, but causes. Be engaged citizens. At the end of the day, that is the answer. You know, I don't mean to touch on a sensitive point, but the state of Wisconsin didn't tip into the Trump column by very much. And had a few more citizens been more engaged, that state would not have been in his column. The same is true in Michigan and to some degree Pennsylvania, North Carolina. So citizen engagement in a democracy is, to me, the most important element.
Mm-hmm. And just one more quick call. John in Fitchburg. Hi.
Hi. Mr. Axelrod, what do you think would, if the chips were such that we got Republicans in control of the Senate, would Barack Obama be willing to be appointed to the Supreme Court as maybe the Chief Justice?
Well, we need a Democratic president, and we need a Democratic Senate probably for that to happen. So you're talking down the line here. And I suspect that he would give the same answer that I gave about sacrifice. I thought before he ran for president that that might be his destiny, that he would be a wonderful Supreme Court justice. At this point, you know, I really am happy for him that he has his life back after giving so much to the country for the last 8 years. And I think he'd be reluctant to commit himself to that, and I think he has things he wants to do relative to both here and around the world in terms of organizing citizens to become engaged, and feels that that may be his best use. So I would say he'd be unlikely to, and let me say, I think there are plenty of very talented people who could fill that role, but before that happens, you need a Senate and a president that would go along. And I think that's a big challenge that lies ahead.
Thank you so much for the call, John. Well, David, one of the things I'll do in retirement, I'm going to raise a therapy dog.
I heard that.
He's coming next week. I'm so excited. We'll be able to walk, and I can listen to all your podcasts. Seriously,
well,
I'm looking forward to it.
I will be a little bit humbled to know that a great interviewer is listening to my conversations, but I appreciate that, and I appreciate what you're doing with a therapy dog. I have a child with intellectual disabilities, and
yes.
We have a dog.
Oh, you do.
That dog is really, really great with her. And so I know the difference that a dog can make in people's lives. So, you know, you're going to keep giving even in retirement, I see, and I appreciate that.
Thanks, David. I appreciate all that you do. And thank you for saying yes to the interview. It's been great. Thanks.
Okay. Great to be here. Good luck to you, Kathleen.
Thanks, David, and to you as well. David Axelrod, chief strategist for Barack Obama's presidential campaigns, and he's on CNN now. He's a senior political analyst. He also does these wonderful podcasts, and some of them are on CNN. They're doing them as television shows, as they did with John Lewis. But he's interviewed, you know, their political focus. He interviews Democrats and Republicans with his good heart and his real knowledge of history and sensitivity to a number of important issues. So it's the Axe Files, in case you're looking for something to listen to when you're retired or when you have a few free minutes. It's definitely worth your time. Well, that was fun. I wanted to interview him for a long time. Many thanks also to Bob Uecker and to Bud Selig for joining us this hour. Hour two is coming up. As you know, we have a market on the Abraham Lincoln and the dog audience. Even David Axelrod talked about his dog. We'll be talking with we'll have Fitzgerald William in our studio, a Basset Hound who's doing therapy work, and his wonderful owner, Molly Johnson, who has 25 years of experience working with registered therapy dogs as an owner, handler, mentor, and positive reinforcement trainer. So they will both be with us to talk about that work, and we'll welcome many of your phone calls. And I know some of you listening are doing that kind of work as well, so please call in. We would like very much to hear from all of you. That's after the news.